You are listening to the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world, brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy, located in Beijing. I am Tong Zhao, an associate in Carnegie's nuclear policy program based at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. I will be your host today. I'm very delighted to be joined by Professor John Garver, who is a professor at the Sam Nan School of International Affairs at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He specializes in Asian international relations, specifically China's foreign relations, and has written considerably on this subject. He is the author of 11 books and over 100 articles dealing with China's foreign relations. His book, The Foreign Relations of the People's Republic of China, is one of the most widely used textbooks in the United States on China's foreign relations. Dr. Garver has served on the editorial boards of a number of journals. He is a member of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations and the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. In the past, Dr. Garver lived in China for 6 years and facilitated various college exchange programs. He enjoys discussing China's foreign relations in various forums and has today joined us in Beijing to talk about the impact of China's rise on its relationship with the United States and its neighbors. So welcome, Dr. Garver, to Carnegie Tsinghua. I'm very thrilled to have you here today.
Thank you very much.
Now let's talk a little bit more about China and the United States. Of course, the U.S. is a major player in the region. The United States is paying a lot of attention to China's so-called periphery diplomacy. Many Chinese neighbors are actually U.S. allies and friends. So United States naturally is closely monitoring what is going on in the Asia Pacific. So given all these new developments in the region in recent years, how do you think this has affected or has changed American calculations and how this has affected Sino-US relations? Right.
The fundamental geopolitical objective of the United States in Asia, I believe, is to prevent the domination of Asia by a single power coalition of powers. That was established as the U.S. strategic objective in 1898 when a guy named William Rockhill, who was, Assistant Secretary of State, devised the logic of the open-door policy. And Rockhill said, well, look, there's the Russian Empire coming into northeast China. We have a lot of interest there, and they're being threatened by Russia. The Japanese are also coming in, and both the Japanese and the Russians think that there should be a special Japanese or Russian sphere of influence. Of course, this was the rivalry which led ultimately to the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905. And William Rockhill thought this through and said, you know, the United States should do is support Daqing Di Guo, support the Qing Empire, support China, because a strong United China will be able to resist Russia, be able to resist Japan, and balance them. And by supporting a strong United China, we can prevent the domination, prevent the encroachment on our interest in China by Russia and Japan. So this was the origin of a long-term American policy of supporting a strong United China as bulwark of a balance in power in Asia. I mean, from the American perspective, as long as power was divided in East Asia among several centers of power, it would not threaten the United States, either the United States security, home territory, or its interests. But if Asia became dominated by a single center of power, then it would constitute both a threat to our interests in Asia and a threat to the homeland of the United States. This, I think, has been the guiding principle of U.S. Asian policy since 1890. Now, in 1971-72, the United States and China came together on the principle of anti-hegemony. Mm. Both sides said that neither sought hegemony in East Asia, and both would oppose the efforts by any power to achieve hegemony in East Asia. Mm. the anti-hegemony understanding between the United States and China was a basis for, has been the basis of a very fruitful 30 years period of cooperation between the countries. I think it was a return to the older U.S. tradition that existed prior to 1949. Warren Cohen, who wrote the most well-used history of U.S.-China relations, U.S. response to China, argues that the 20 years between 22 years between 1949 and 1971 was a great aberration, that the broader pattern to which the United States returned in 1972 was of cooperation with China to maintain a stable balance of power in Asia. What's happening now, I think, in the Sino-U.S. relation is that China's increasing the assertive use of its power towards its small neighbors, and the insistence of China that the United States stay out of these conflicts is increasingly raising the specter in the United States that China might achieve hegemony over East Asia. Now, it's not a question of intentions. When countries drive for hegemony, curiously enough, in many cases, they don't seek hegemony. The United States' rise to global preeminence started in 1940. When the U.S. leadership under Franklin D. Roosevelt decided we had to use American power to support Britain in standing alone in Europe against Nazi Europe, and China in East Asia standing alone against the Empire of Japan. And the United States began mobilizing its resources for an all-out confrontation with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And the consequence of that, of course, was by 1945, those empires had been destroyed, and the United States was a global hegemon, challenged only by the USSR. But global hegemony was not the objective of the United States in 1940. I mean, that was a result of American policies. That was the outcome of American policies. But the objective for the United States in 1940 was to prevent the domination of Europe by Nazi Germany and prevent the domination of Asia by the Imperial Japan. And by the way, to prevent when those two powers, Nazi Germany and Japan, came together in the Tripartite Treaty in September 1940, whoa, that was the greatest threat to the American security that ever existed, maybe since the British burned Washington in 1812. Mm. So, and when I talk this matter over with my Chinese colleagues, and I have many times, the response is, we don't seek hegemony, of course, but that's not the point. Of course you don't seek hegemony, but the outcome of China's responses could be hegemony. For example, if in the conflicts between China, powerful China, and weak neighbors, the Americans abide by the principle of, well, we'll stay out of these are purely bilateral countries, and you, Philippines and China, work out your own problems. And of course, in that purely bilateral equation, what can the Philippines do but kuto? Well, the result would be, the result could be a major step towards hegemony. Not that China, intends this or imagines this. I mean, the Chinese self-perception is, we don't threaten your neighbor. We don't have any aggressive territorial demands. We don't, the result of that, first of all, that's not the perception of China's neighbors. And secondly, the unintended consequence of the successful implementation of Chinese policy could well be Chinese hegemony. I mean, if Japan agrees to stay non-military, minor military power, if Taiwan is assimilated into the Chunghwa Renmin Gonghwaguo on the basis of Iguoliangzhi, and if all the little countries of Southeast Asia basically say, all the South China Sea belongs to China, and we don't have any 200-mile EEZ, and any security issues we have with China, we'll talk with China only, that goes an awful long way toward looking like Chinese hegemony. And this is the specter I see that's confronting China and the United States.
So talking about U.S.-China relations, we cannot really avoid discussing the so-called new type of great power relations. President Xi Jinping himself is very much committed to this concept. And during the APEC summit last year in Beijing, President Xi met with President Obama, and they had in-depth exchanges on related issues. So what's your opinion of China's proposal for a new type of great power relations between China and the United States? You have talked about the U.S. perspective of the need to balance the geopolitics in Asia Pacific, avoid the emergence of hegemonic power in the region. But if we look at the current proposal from the Chinese side, do you think this new type of great power relations model is a practical one for managing the so-called the most important bilateral relationship in the world?
On the one hand, on the other hand, the answer is not simple. You know, I think that the inspiration for this notion of a new type of great power relationship was inspired by the understanding of the tragic history of rise of great powers, the Thucydides trap, the fear of rising powers inspired in the minds of incumbent great powers, and a ardent desire to avoid that, to avoid a confrontation between the United States and China. And who could object to that? So I think that that is the fundamental origin of that. On the other hand, if the United States agrees to respect China's core interests, the crux of this new type of great power relationship, as I understand it, is a promise by both sides to respect the core interests of the other. If the United States makes that promise, as I understand President Obama did, then whenever China says, this is in our core interest, this is in our core interest, and you promise to respect our core interest, therefore you have to do what we want you to do on this, why, two things follow. That's one, an invitation to China to say, this is our core interest, then you promise to obey it. And secondly, it provides China with a ready-made negotiating leverage of insincerity. There's a fundamental asymmetry in there are many asymmetries in the governmental structures of China and the United States. One is that Chinese officials stay in office for long periods of time, 10, 20, 30 years, and accumulate immense experience. Whereas the leading officials in U.S. executive agencies rotate through those on a 2 or 4 or at most 8-year schedule. So what happens is the Chinese officials know the negotiating record. They know it very well. But you might have an American official, assistant secretary, deputy secretary of state, that's been in office for 1 or 2 years, and they don't know it. Mm. And what the U.S. found, what the U.S. government found in negotiating, was the Chinese would often say, would, from the American perspective, say, manipulate the negotiating record to say, you promised this and that, when in fact the Americans hadn't promised this and that. It was a negotiating tactic. And so what the U.S. State Department did was commission a study by a prominent American China specialist, a guy named Richard Solomon, who I believe now is head of the U.S. Institute of Peace, to do a study of China's negotiating strategy. Yeah. And Solomon issued a very good 2-volume study. One was an analysis and the other was a chronology of China's negotiating strategy. And one of the basic conclusions of that study was that the common Chinese negotiation strategy is to get their opponent, the other side, to agree to a principle, and then to use that principle to lever the other side. And you agree to the principle, and then if you're in a situation the other side doesn't comply, in China's views, with that principle, then the charge is insincerity. If the other side is insincere, well, they have to prove their sincerity. So the conclusion of Solomon's study, there was this, I think, in the early 80s, maybe. It's called Negotiating Strategy of the People's Republic of China, something like that. Was Solomon's conclusion was that, well, to abstain from making these commitments, to negotiate the issues. You know, what are the issues on the table? We'll negotiate these issues, but we don't need to put it in a large principle framework, because to do that gives China a negotiating advantage. And of course, it's exactly to secure that negotiating advantage that China pushes for principles at first. So if you put the new type of great power relationship in that framework, China is pushing for a principle which it then will use as leverage with the United States on issue after issue. When President Obama made that commitment, again, my understanding, I'm just a professor, but my understanding is there were a lot of opposition within the U.S. government, especially from the Defense Department. They thought that was a bad idea, exactly for the same reason that Richard Solomon alluded to. It's not as though the American military wants a confrontation with China, you know, but they don't want to create a situation in which China might be invited to say this is our core issue, and therefore the United States, to prove its sincerity, had better do what we say.
I mean, it's a very interesting point. Even though I may not call that a Chinese strategy, rather than I think it more reflects the Chinese way of thinking. It more reflects a Chinese philosophy that has deep roots in its political culture. China is inclined to first clarify the general principles, general guidelines, and that reflects your sincerity in the negotiations, and then we can, it's easier for us then to discuss the practical issues, the operational issues, the technical issues. So I think that more reflects the Chinese way of thinking. But I think that's a very interesting point, and you also pointed out that China and United States have different government structures, and that also influence the way they talk to each other. I think that's a very good and interesting point. In your writings, you have mentioned about the great power transition that seems to be underway. Do you think the most recent contestation between the United States and China over China's land reclamation activity in South China Sea a result of such great power transition? And if so, how can China and the United States do, or what can China and the United States do to ease the tensions associated with the great power transition?
Thank you. I think you framed the question very well at the very beginning. What's happening is China's power is greater and greater, and China's leaders have decided to use that power with greater assertive, with some degree of assertiveness to defend China's claims, to secure China's claims. And that's very popular with the Chinese people, and that popularity is a factor inspiring that. And you have a growth of Chinese naval capabilities. A Chinese aircraft carrier, for example, is not a major concern to the United States Navy. It is a major concern to the Philippines. It is a major concern to Vietnam. A major factor constraining Chinese military capabilities in the Spratly areas has been the great distance from Chinese air bases, and the fact that to reach those distances in the Spratly Islands, Chinese airplanes had to carry a lot of fuel, which means they don't carry many munitions, and it means when they get there, they have about 5 minutes and have to turn around and go back. But an aircraft carrier and landing strips in the South China Sea will greatly increase China's ability to assert control over that area. And so the land reclamation, together with the aircraft carrier, and the general, the broader growth of Chinese military capabilities, I agree with your formulation that China is using its greater and greater military capabilities to assert its claims, you can say to defend its claims, in these disputed regions. There's a couple of points. I mean, one is the freedom of navigation. Since its founding, the United States has been a commercial republic that has seen commerce on the sea-based commerce as central to the American vitality, to American wealth, American power. The United States is a commercial republic, is and always has been a commercial republic. So navigation, freedom of the sea is important, and the South China Sea is a major transportation corridor. But I don't think that's the fundamental thing. I mean, the United States, other ships, all ships could go around there. But the more fundamental thing is the Philippine alliance with the United States. The Philippines and the United States have had this alliance since 1940. I guess 47, the Philippines became independent in 1946, before the establishment of the People's Republic of China, before the Soviet Union really arrived in Asia. But we have this traditional relationship, and the Philippines threatens that its vital economic interest, its vital territorial interest, is being threatened by China's activities in the South China Sea. And so weak Philippines and strong China, what do they do? Well, they're turning to the Americans and say, will you support us? And so the Americans are given the choice of, do we support the Philippines and participate in the encirclement of China, or do we not support the Philippines, thereby telling the Philippines, you're on your own. And the Philippines can go to Japan and India, and they're going to Japan and India, but Japan and India might not be adequate. And so the Philippines' choice will be to rely on maybe a potentially untrustworthy partner like India and Japan, or Kyoto to China. And then we're back to this basic security dilemma of Chinese hegemony in East Asia. I mean, if the whole South China Sea is China's territorial sea, and Vietnam doesn't have a 200-mile EEZ, and Taiwan is incorporated into the PRC, And Japan agrees to minimal military power, and maybe to, you know, dissolve its alliance with the United States, or allow that alliance with the United States to be conditioned by China. That looks an awful lot like hegemony. And then you put in the political consequences of these very ambitious road building projects, Idai-Ilu, and you have a scary outcome from the standpoint of the United States.
Right. I also think that, you know, Chinese territorial claims over South China Sea is not very clear, but it did officially stated that it does not claim the entire South China Sea as its territorial water. You also mentioned about the freedom of navigation in South China Sea, and I don't think the civilian shipping in South China Sea is affected at all, and I think China has no intentions, and I think China has made it very clear that civilian shipping will never be affected. What might be affected is the activity of some military vessels or airplanes in some areas of water in the South China Sea, but that's totally different from civilian shipping. But in either case, I think South China Sea, the tension over South China Sea is just one example or one indication of the concept of so-called great power transition that you mentioned. So at the strategic level, especially between the US and China, what should the two countries do to manage this great power transition, to make it less confrontational, and make it a smooth transition, if it is going to happen at all?
Given that what's underway in the world today is this profound power transition, the emergence of a new global power, and the challenge that necessarily presents to an incumbent world, it's remarkable to me that China-US relations are as good as they are. Economic relationship is very strong, the cultural relations are very strong. What's going on here, this cultural relationship, the growing interaction between the peoples of the two countries, there's a strength, a remarkable strength to US-China relations based upon, I think, cultural and economic factors. And the leaderships of both sides and the mainstream of public opinion on both sides are committed to avoiding confrontation. I think that the leaders of both sides and the peoples, the mainstream political thinking, about popular thinking on both sides, recognize that a confrontation would be disastrous for both, regardless of who wins at the end. Exactly how you do that, well, you know, the standard rubric is to increase dialogue and increase mutual trust and eliminate strategic mistrust. And for example, this podcast and things like that, we multiply by 1,000. And well, you know, I wouldn't disparage that. I think it's useful. But again, I come back to, I think that, to my mind, the greater danger is that, I guess the greatest danger is that China's people and even maybe their analysts don't really understand how China's behavior, as China's action, is perceived by its neighbors. From Japan's perspective, the Philippines perspective, from the Indian perspective, which we've not talked about, from the Vietnamese perspective, China is an aggressor. You know, and China is, you know, claiming territory, asserting its control over territory that it hasn't asserted before. That's not the case in India, but in the case of the Philippines and Vietnam and Japan. So there's no easy solution. I'm afraid I can't provide the magic solution to this deepening security dilemma.
This is the toughest geopolitical question everyone is facing today. But I do agree with you that it's really important that everyone try to put oneself into the shoes of the other and try to develop more sympathy towards the other's positions and perception. And that would be really important.
Let me just add, we'll give one other answer. I think that one way to strengthen the US-China relationship is to enhance our cooperation in areas of common concern. The American idea has been that we, and the Chinese idea, I think, under Mao and Zhou, was that we set aside areas of disagreement, identify areas of common agreement, and cooperate in those areas. And I think that China is, in the last several years, become more willing to, we earlier referred to China's increasing activity, the proactive diplomacy. And I think that one manifestation of that is increased Chinese willingness to cooperate with the United States, actively to cooperate with the United States. In Afghanistan, you see that. I think you see that in the Iran nuclear talks. China has played a very, in 2012, 13, 14, China's played a very, very interesting role in the Iran nuclear talks, trying to mediate between Iran and the United States to resolve, peacefully resolve the Iran nuclear issue. And I think that's a great thing. It's a very important manifestation of China's cooperation. If China and the United States can cooperate on issues like the Iran nuclear issue in Afghanistan, or the maintenance of peace and stability in Pakistan, or managing the whole series of problems related to that, that I think would go a long way towards lessening strategic mistrust.
Great. On that optimistic note, Dr. Garber, thank you very much for spending time with me today and for offering very insightful comments. I deeply appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's been a great pleasure seeing you again and being here today. Thank you very much.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. If you'd like to read or learn more about U.S.-China relationship, you can find more articles, events, and podcasts on our website at www.carnegietsinghua.org. I encourage you to visit and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.